Well, it's wonderful that I've had the opportunity to sit down and talk to you.
Why is that, Don?
Because I love Waverly Place, and in fact, it was one of these books that was so hard to put down, I didn't. I picked it up on a Sunday afternoon and finished it Sunday evening, so it was the kind of book that read so well, and it was so hypnotic as you developed these characters and looked into their lives, so I thought it was a wonderful book. I thoroughly enjoyed it. You had an awful lot of publicity already. I mean, you've been talking and talking about this, and you've had all of these articles and interviews and everything.
I seem to have that happen to me with every book I publish. I don't know why it is. I mean, I don't feel I'm a confrontational, controversial person, and yet my books somehow seem to be in a swirl of controversy from the minute they're published.
Yeah. I wish I had that problem.
Well, maybe I can give you some pointers. Novels usually do not get news kind of publicity. That's true.
But, of course, in your case, the novel came out at a time, well, the timing was perfect, I guess.
Well, you know, there are some who think that either I or Grove Press, exercised some kind of marketing genius. That's not how it happened at all. I did write the book in a white heat. The day that Lisa Steinberg died, I guess I was so upset that I had to work it out in fiction, a form that I had never used before. But the book went its normal publishing course. I did finish it fast for me. I mean, my books take 4 to 8 years, I'm ashamed to say, my nonfiction books. I did this in under a year. I turned in my manuscript, I think, 6 months after I started it, and then there was an editorial process in another few months. But we had a complete manuscript in July. It was published in February, so that's a normal time. I mean, who knew? I mean, I certainly didn't know when I started to write, and Grove Press didn't know when it made its publication schedule, that there would be this trial and a verdict in the week of publication. That was an accident. And I'm not so sure it helps me, actually.
Well, I think it would indeed help you with so much attention focused on that trial and the book, in effect, about that same...
But it is my feeling that if Hedda Nussbaum's face had not become so familiar to people because of her 7 days of testimony at the Steinberg trial as a government witness against her live-in lover, people might be able to look at my novel more as a novel, more as an act of invention and creation, and might marvel at what I was able to accomplish when I wrote it, rather than hold Waverly Place up to the mirror of Hedda Nussbaum and judge it like that. But, however, I'm not complaining. I can't complain.
Well, say something. She did was change the names.
Well, some people have thought that, or some people thought I attended the trial and was scribbling frantically, and the book appeared a week later. But those are people who don't know about the publishing process or the writing process.
I was wondering if... I know that you've been doing a lot of publicity on the book. I was wondering, what if the jury was still out during the week where you were doing all the publicity? That would, would you still go to the courtroom or do the publicity on the book?
I felt as a journalist, I tried to be very careful down in that courtroom. I didn't want my fellow members of the press to think that I was there looking for personal publicity. I attended the trial for two reasons. One was to see how the characters in my novel were in real life. And the other reason was that I had an assignment from Ms. Magazine to write an essay on Hedda Nussbaum herself. And that assignment is quite separate from the novel Waverly Place, which was written, of course, before there was a trial.
Well, in Waverly Place, where does the fiction begin and the nonfiction?
Don, this is a... You see, I believe when I was writing that everything I wrote was real, but that was my delusion, you see. I felt that I understood what had happened to this lawyer and this woman who had once been an editor and a writer, and I felt I understood their folie à deux and how it came to pass that a child died. So I felt that all of it was true and all of it was psychologically accurate. Obviously, it isn't all true. However, I must tell you, since you are a novelist and we can share trade secrets, that I researched this book a lot. And people spoke to me, people connected to the Steinberg-Nisbaum case, spoke to me who wouldn't speak to a journalist or somebody writing nonfiction. Now, the book opens with the paramedic who climbs up the stairs and is the first to see the child and to treat the child and give her... he does the Heimlich maneuver on her, and then he says, well, his first response is she looked dead, and then he goes in the ambulance with the child and the father to the St. Vincent's Hospital, and he notices that the father is acting like he's turned in a broken appliance, and then he thinks, I have been in the presence of evil. That's all true. I had an interview with St. Vincent's paramedic who told me these things. And he agreed to talk with me because he had read Against Our Will, my book on rape, and he thought I was a serious person, and even though St. Vincent's has a policy of not cooperating with journalists, he felt he wanted to cooperate with me because I was writing fiction, and the case had disturbed him so much that he had to talk to somebody. So the book does open with something quite factual.
Well, there are a lot of, obviously, there are factual events. The trip down the freeway, the booking, on and on there are these facts. But yet, there are other elements that are obviously fiction. Now, the other neighbors, the gay couple, for example, on the first floor, and the other people in the building, I think the journalist in the building and so forth, were these were made up?
All made up.
Yeah.
I made up all the neighbors and all the people at the publishing house. I figured, I mean, since this was my first novel, I thought if I can't make up neighbors and give them responses that I feel I would have had, you know, in varying degrees, they're different neighbors, they all have slightly different responses, but the responses were all mine. And if I couldn't populate a publishing house, since I, I've been in and out of publishing houses in my life, well, then I just couldn't call myself a novelist at all. That was easy, to make up neighbors and co-workers. That was
Well, what about other events, such as Barry's relationship with the lawyers with whom he shared offices?
Well, a bit of that had been in the papers, and I did call one of his former law partners, and I said, look, I need psychological insights and anecdotes if you have any. And we had a long phone conversation, and I was able to spin many, many little scenes out of that one phone conversation with one of Joel Steinberg's former law partners.
What about the boat?
It had been in the paper that he had a boat. No, that was a funny one for me, actually. It had been in Newsday that he had a 30-foot-plus sloop, and that he used to let little Lisa steer it. I couldn't imagine that. Also, I didn't know that much about boats, so I went to the boat show at the Coliseum last year, and I looked at boats, and I tried to find a boat that I could relate to, that I felt comfortable on, that I could have this little six-year-old on. And I found a 22-foot boat, not a 30-foot boat. The 30-foot boats were too intimidating for me. I couldn't write a scene on a 32-foot boat. But I felt real good about this black 22-foot, a Rhodes 22, that's what it was. I fell in love with that boat at the boat show. So I was able to put the little girl and her father on that boat.
Well, I think beyond the facts of the matter, I think what you were trying to do more than anything else was to capture the spirit, the feeling of these people and the event.
And the neighborhood, it's Greenwich Village, it's my neighborhood. I thought to myself, I ought to be able to describe my own police precinct. I ought to be able to describe these streets, this changing neighborhood. I enjoyed that a lot because I think basically I'm not a descriptive writer.
A non-descriptive
writer? I am not a descriptive writer. But I felt that my strength lay in dialogue, because I've off and on over the years tried to write plays and failed to complete plays. But I do get my characters in a situation, and I do get them talking. So I felt I could handle dialogue, but I felt that I was weak on on description, but I worked hard on description. I worked hard to describe my very own neighborhood, my very own park, Washington Square Park and Abingdon Square Park. I mean, I mean, for goodness sakes, I kept saying to myself, you've seen it, you know it better than other people. Well, write a description of it, for goodness sakes. So I did. I think my problem with the plays that I start and never finish, and the reason I never attempted fiction before, was that I'm also not strong on plot. But you see, this came with its ending, and all I had to do was begin it and take it to its ending, so the plot was ready made.
I didn't think modern novelists worry too much about plot these days.
Oh, you mean I shouldn't have been worrying all these years?
Most of the books I read are essentially plotless. They are character developments.
Yes, I'm thinking of Renata Adler and Spiva. That's true.
Now, of course, you're known for your nonfiction and your feminist writing. When you approach the novel, now you said that you felt you were weak on narrative and but strong on dialogue, but this was certainly a different kind of book than you had ever done. Did you have problems adjusting to it?
Well, I wondered if I'd be any good at it. It was clear to me after I had written 30 pages, and I started with this totally made-up scene about how Barry and Judith meet at a Greenwich Village street fair, made it up. I had trouble with the first sentence and thought, well, I just gave myself a little exhortation. I mean, I said, look, kid, you are not writing literature here. Let's just see if you can write something that's good enough to get published. I tried to think of a paperback book somewhere on a shelf. If I could just write well enough in fiction so that it would pass, it would be respectable enough to be published. I thought, well, that's all I will hope for. I wasn't intending to win any literary prizes. The style, as the style developed, I noticed, I mean, the part of me that was always watching as I was writing, I noticed it was journalistic. And that didn't surprise me, actually, because my background was journalism. So the terseness of the sentences, the descriptions, even the dialogue, the short scenes, the economy of language, seemed to be my natural style because I've spent all my life as a journalist. So that's how it worked out.
One of the things that I like, well, there is that phrase, I can't remember who said it, was it one of the police officers, you just mentioned it, in the presence of evil?
Yeah, that was the paramedic. Yeah.
Actually, yeah. Barry wasn't all evil. Barry was probably very much like most of us are, although he's certainly an excessive man. But at times he was perfectly charming. There were times you could see that he regretted what he did. I mean, at one point he's talking about the plastic surgery for Judith that he should have had a long time ago. His relationship with the little girl in the book, of course. I mean, carrying her on his shoulders. I thought the scenes with the boat and how he had trouble trying to maneuver it and everything, I thought those were delightful. So in many respects, Barry was every man. But there was something dark. I mean, obviously, not everyone does the kinds of things he did. But I think what you did, the resulting portrait, was of a complex individual and not a black and white person.
Well, I thought that was what a novelist was supposed to do. I thought if I were dealing in nonfiction and writing an essay on these people, I would have been more harsh and judgmental. But I learned that much, at least, in my 53 years on this planet, that if you're going to write a novel, you just tell the story and you let it happen and you try to understand your characters. You certainly try to motivate them. But you don't stand on your high horse and look down on them and judge them. I knew that. I mean, that was one of the few novelist skills that I came to this book with that I was certain about, and that you have compassion for your characters and you tell the story.
But a hack writer would create a villain and he's all villain, or a hero is all hero. You see this in a lot of the genre fiction. So, but in life, of course, all people are complex. And so I think that's was nicely reflected. You said a moment ago that you wrote Waverly Place in a white heat.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
I'm not known for writing fast with Against Our Will and Femininity. If I wrote a page at the end of the day, I'd feel that was wonderful. Well, you know, since it was nonfiction, I was always referring back to the sources and the citations to make sure I got it accurate, and then I had to weigh everything and were the things that I was saying true to the actual event I was describing. With this, I wrote 3 pages a day, which was just an enormous output for me. I stayed with it from early morning till the evening. I just took breaks for food and walking the dog and the rest of my life. But it was a totally obsessive experience combined with productivity that was thrilling. It was absolutely thrilling to me. I was never at a loss for where to move my characters next. There were so many things that they were saying to each other that I couldn't write down fast enough. I hope to have this experience again sometime in life.
You will.
You think so?
Oh, yes.
Should I do...
Well, I was thinking that there's more to be said about Barry and Judith. A lot more to be said. Given time, you might want to say it. Where are they now? In other words, where are they now? A follow-up to this book. What happens when Barry leaves prison? How does Judith recover and get her life back together? I mean...
Or do they end up together somewhere, huh?
You know, they might. She might be waiting for him when he gets out of the slammer.
I think that would be the novel I'd write next if I was going to do a sequel.
I mean, I don't think that's going to come next year, but at some point you might, these characters might well remain in your conscious, and you might.
What a nice idea. What a really nice idea. Maybe I'll do that. Yeah, well, I certainly hated to, you know this too. I mean, some of my favorite characters, I love all my characters, but... the Headingtons, Don and Ellie Headington. She has the rich father, and he wants to paint, and they grow dope in Vermont. I adored the Headingtons when I created them, and I was very sorry when they got phased out of the novel, because they were Barry's clients, and then after they got sent to jail and he disowned them, you know, they had no further business being in the novel. But I was so sorry to see them go. And I have heard novelists say this about their characters, that they cry when their characters get killed or something, because, you know, they had brought them to life and now they're not there anymore. And I did feel that way about my characters.
Yeah, I like them too. I was surprised that that she got that 1 year in jail. I thought she was going to at least get off. Was there a parallel to that in Steinberg?
Yes, there was, but they were cocaine dealers. Yes, there was John Novak and his wife, and they were in the papers. And I thought it would be better for my fictional purposes to, instead of having cocaine dealers in that particular part of the story, to reduce them to marijuana growers in the Northeast Kingdom in Vermont.
Yes. Tell me a little bit about your other work. You're often referred to as a feminist writer. What exactly is a feminist writer?
I'm laughing because it haunts me. My editor, Aaron Asher at Grove, says it's sort of like one word for these people when they talk about you, isn't it? The feminist writer, the feminist author. Well, what could I say? I am a feminist and I am a writer. Yes. So if people want to use that shorthand, it's okay. I feel it probably is a turnoff to some people who might want to read a novel, but hearing that it's written by a feminist author might make them feel that it's going to be a political tract and not a novel at all. I'm interested in the question of the political novel. I certainly know people who attempt the political novel with varying degrees of success. When I sat down to write Waverly Place, I did not intend to write a political novel, a feminist novel, not at all. I wanted simply to tell a story that I felt I had to tell.
Well, feminist books were in vogue some time ago, especially when you were in your heyday and with your books, but there are not as many books being written about feminism now, are there? Or am I off the beam on this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, probably have you interviewed Marilyn French or Marge Piercy?
Yes, I've interviewed Marge Piercy and Adrienne Rich, a number of writers. But even they tell me that they have this feeling that, in a way, the victory was won, and there's less to say.
They told you the victory was won?
In effect. Well, they didn't say it. In effect, the victory, strides have been made. The victory was apparent, and there's less to be said. Is this accurate?
No, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that. I think people are less interested in hearing certain things and in reading certain kinds of books now. I remember overhearing a conversation between two women about Marilyn French's The Women's Room, and this was just a few years ago, and they were talking about books they'd read, and they viewed their reading The Women's Room at that time as this very radical act on their part. And they were thinking that today they wouldn't, and they weren't interested in her as a writer anymore. I was astonished to overhear that conversation. I think I thought that Marilyn French's books did very well because they appealed to a certain readership that was out there, and that was it. So I don't know, I was confused when I heard that conversation.
Where is the feminist battle today? Where do women stand?
Well, we're in a time when there is very little of left of the feminist movement for very, very complicated reasons. Some of the more obvious reasons are that people don't want to hear what we have to say anymore. Another reason is that we said so much so fast that people are still chewing the cud. I mean, our issues of abortion, rape, battery, prostitution, pornography, were complex and dealt with sex and created a tremendous upheaval in the lives of many people, made them think new thoughts, perhaps made their lives more difficult because they had to think new thoughts and act on those new thoughts. So I think that movements come and go, and there are waves, and we reach plateaus, and nobody wants to hear from movement people anymore. And then 10, 20 years down the road, people are going to want to start talking about feminism again. But for those of us who are movement-oriented and who are activists, either by nature or by decision, it's not wonderful to be in a quiescent time. I liked being a movement activist a lot. I really did. I felt it was a constructive way to deal with things that I thought were wrong all around me. And I miss it now. I miss it.
What are some of the issues confronting women now that you feel are important that still need to be addressed?
Well, I think the same ones we've always had. Battery and child abuse. They haven't gone away. The rape statistics are horrible. The ability or inability to have a career and also have a family. How much have men changed? I don't think women feel, and I really mean all women. I'm going to speak for all women on this one. I don't think women feel that men have changed enough to suit us.
And what way should men change? What would be agreeable to you?
I'm not in that racket anymore, John. Come on, I'm a novelist now.
Now you deal with character development. But seriously, how would you want to see men change?
Now all right, listen, let's bring it right back to Waverly Place. I have noticed, you are an exception here, but I have noticed that men have distanced themselves from Joel Steinberg and from the death of Lisa Steinberg so successfully that they've managed to make it into a woman's problem. Women are obsessed with Hedda Nussbaum, and we have this debate raging about whether there is or is not a piece of Hedda Nussbaum in us all, and whether she is a representative of the battered woman, and is she a heroine, or was she simply the grateful recipient of an immunity deal, when she testified? But it seems to be an issue that has engaged women and not men. And I'll just bet you that 90% of the readers of Waverly Place are going to be women, the same way they were for Against Our Will, which was the book about rape, which men also managed to conveniently say was somehow a woman's issue, but that's the men who are the rapists. And by and large, it's the men who are the batterers. But men have this remarkable ability to walk away from certain problems and feel that those problems are women's issues.
I do a lot of dial switching on the radio, and I like to go through these talk shows, most of which are hosted by men, a lot of them on WOR and WABC and WMCA. And, of course, the Steinberg case was a huge topic of conversation for weeks and weeks. But on almost every broadcast, Joel Steinberg was castigated. This is not the same thing as walking away from Steinberg. I remember Barry Gray urging after the jury came in and say it was a wrong verdict, it should have been guilty and he should be executed. He's screaming in the telephone and this sort of, and on you kept hearing that. Now that's not distancing oneself from Steinberg,
isn't it? It's saying that this person is such a monster that you find no humanity in him, right? Now you were just saying earlier in a tremendous compliment to me that you felt that my character of Barry Cantor had complexity,
mm-hmm.
right? No doubt Joel Steinberg has complexity, too.
Right.
But in that distancing that men do, it makes it very safe for them. Perhaps some of the men who called Steinberg a monster were men who have hit their wives or hit their children. However, women don't distance themselves from Hedda Nussbaum. So many seem to feel that they could be in her situation. Now, I find that incomprehensible. But the women in the discussions about Hedda go circle round and round and round on the question of, could this child have been saved by Hedda? Could Hedda have acted differently? Should she have? Well, of course she should have. But women are engaged by it, and they don't draw back and call her a monster to the same degree. Some do. But don't you see that
mm-hmm.
gender difference? Yeah. Yeah.
Let's sidetrack a little bit, go back a little bit. Just give me a little sketch about yourself. Are you a New Yorker?
I'm born in Brooklyn. I had relatives in the Bronx. That's why you see I created in my early scenes the Romeo and Juliet of the Brooklyn and the Bronx. Yeah.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to Midwood High School in Brooklyn, and I went to Cornell.
After school, you went into publishing.
Oh, no.
What
happened? Oh, no. I went into acting. I went into waitressing, actually.
Well, that's the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Two of the jury people in the Steinberg trial were actor/waiter. Yeah, or actress/waitress. Yes, I called those my dark years when I studied acting. I was very unsuccessful as an actress, but it left me with this lifelong dream to write a play one day.
Mm-hmm.
But I started, since I was such a terrible waitress, too, I began to get editorial jobs. I found I did better, quite frankly, working for Newsweek than I did working at the Fifth Avenue coffee shop. So I backed into writing that way. Then I went into television, which was fun for me.
That's right. I recall in the little bio here. You were a news writer at ABC.
Yeah. And I liked television because I felt, it was a bit of theater in there, you know, and I felt that those years maybe weren't altogether lost, my actress years. But I always thought I'd write books. Come on, when I was 20, I wanted to write a novel. You know, it's just, it seemed not a sensible thing to do in life. Of course, I'm not saying that being an actress was sensible, but it seemed even less sensible to roll the piece of paper into the typewriter and say, I will be a writer.
It's so hard.
Well, there are a lot of people who want to do it, and a few can earn a living at it. But probably more people earn a living at it in this country than any other country, because we have such a large country that we do have enough readers to support some people.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your publishing career.
Well, Where do you want to start? I was very happy at Simon & Schuster. In 1971, they gave me $10,000 to write a book on rape, and 1970 they gave that to me, and 4 years later I came in with this book, Against Our Will, which made them very happy. And
maybe I'm confused. Oh, you did not actually work in publishing, did you?
No, I worked at magazines. I never worked at a publishing house. No. But, you know, I would go up there occasionally. When a book is published, you get to see them.
Oh, yeah.
And it's nice. They take you out to lunch. They never take you out to lunch while you're writing, but that's when you need the sustenance.
I was going to go into Against Our Will. I was going to ask you how that book came up, because that was a breakthrough book both for the feminist movement and for yourself. And you even got an advance on the book. That's great.
I was not an unknown writer at the time. I had been working at the Village Voice. I had written for the Times Magazine, Esquire, Vogue. So I was kind of a known quantity. The women's movement discovered rape. I just was the one who wrote its history. And I remain grateful to the movement for that book, because we all discovered rape at the same time. When I say we all, I mean the feminists that I was closest to at that time in my consciousness-raising group. But then I went to the library and worked for 4 years and wrote the book. Occasionally I have run up against, an old movement feminist will say, we all wrote your book, and that gets my back up, and I'll say, which page did you write?
Should I split the royalties with you?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, after that, took an enormous amount of time to write my second book, Femininity, which was a book I had wanted to write before the book on rape. And I used a personal voice in that, which may not, or may have worked. I don't know. I'm not certain. I mean, I don't think that book was as well received as the rape book. And I think that had to do with the fact that by that time people were tired of hearing from feminists.
Now, the rape book was right on the crest of the feminist movement.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
You seem to have a pretty good knack for timing.
Oh, well, I knew you were going to say that. Yeah, well, you think it's my old theatrical training. You think I'm really just sitting there snapping my fingers, figuring out the timing. No, it's just that I'm engaged with issues that other people are engaged with, and I'm engaged with them earlier than other people are engaged with them, and that's why I've been in movements a lot.
I'm always late. I mean, I found out about the Beatles after they had broken up. And then I got to like them, you know, and it stopped recording. It was terrible, you know. I said, where have I been? You know, I just have been in a time warp or something like that. Waverly Place, of course, is a much different book, obviously, a novel. But I'm sure completing it gave you a great deal of pleasure. Are you going to do it again? Are you going to go after more fiction?
I think I'm going to have to wait to see what the critical response is altogether to this book. I'd like to be let into the ranks of the novelists. I'm not so sure they're going to let me in. I really mean that, Don. I think that there must be resentment out there. I mean, they people must think, oh, we've had to deal with her as this feminist theorist, and now she claims she wants, you know, she's a novelist. Well, we're not going to let her. I don't know. I was in the middle of a nonfiction book on friendship when Waverly Place overtook me, and I suppose I should go back to it. I think I'd rather continue to write fiction, but you're one of the few people who has suggested that maybe I should.
I definitely think you should. Of course, I like fiction a lot. I also like nonfiction books, of course, but I like the fiction form, because you can see the author thinking. I mean, really thinking in a creative way, not just touching on issues necessarily, but the way you the portraits of people and ideas and flashbacks fiction can move me. I don't know about all readers, but fiction can move me in a way that a lot of nonfiction cannot. I get angry in reading books that deal with social issues, nonfiction books, but with fiction, you have the ability to express things that you can't express in nonfiction.
That's what I've always believed. But there are lots of howevers there.
See, fiction tells you how people really think, really think. You get inside of people and you learn things that...
You mean the characters or the author? The author.
Well, the characters are reflect
yes,
the author.
Yes, in all the author's facets. Yeah. But see, that's why I thought, you see, I would never write a nonfiction book on battery, because I know that battery is this complex relationship between two people. It is not an isolated single act like the act of rape. So that's why I knew to write a novel if I was going to deal with battery and child abuse. But, all right, how about this as a problem in life, that the ones who are applauded, the novelists who are applauded by a select handful of critics, and they are not necessarily the ones who can earn a living at writing novels, because their work is on the cutting edge of what's being done in fiction, right? So they will get critical acclaim, but they're going to have to work at a university, right, and teach.
Well, Susan Brettmiller, we're just about out of time, but I did want to say that I just wanted to repeat that I thought The Waverly Place was a wonderful book. I want to see another one from you. And also glad to see that Grove Press is coming into the mainstream. You know, when Barney Rossett ran it had strange little books that came out. I loved Grove, you know, and I loved Barney Rossett. He was so funny. I've interviewed him a couple times. And he's so funny. You know, I asked him once, I said, well, how do you know how many copies of a book to print? He says, I don't know. I said, well, but... when the book is ready to go out, you know, you have to tell the printer how many copies. He said, that's right. I said, well, how many? I mean, on a he said, well, it depends. I said, well, on the an average book that Grove Press, would it be 2,000 copies? He said, yeah, maybe. 5,000 copies? Yeah. 10,000 copies? Could be. I thought, gee, that's very strange. Here's a guy who's running a publishing house, and he's only guessing. He has no idea. But he's right. You can't really have marketing studies on a novel that hasn't come out, can you?
No, well, what they say in publishing is if they could predict it, they'd print nothing but bestsellers. But obviously they can't. I mean, I'm more familiar with the nonfiction side. You know, Alan Bloom's book, The Close of the American Mind, had an initial print order of 5,000. I don't think that Stephen Hawking had much more. But sometimes when they get out there, there really is a readership waiting. But then, of course, there are the other books where they'll print 200,000 and they sit. But they get on the bestseller list anyway because the book stores have ordered so many copies and have them down there in their cellar. They have to report them just to get them.
I wondered about that. Sometimes before pub date, I'll pick up the New York Times and there's that book, which I haven't even seen, and it's on the bestseller list. And I began to think, you know, it probably doesn't have to sell too many books to get on the New York Times bestseller list. It's impossible. First week of publication is on the bestseller list already?
I have often thought that the dynamic in operation there is that the booksellers have bought so many copies, and then they instantly start to second-guess themselves, and they figure the only way out of their own dilemma is to report it as a bestseller, because once it's on the list, it perpetuates itself, and then people do... There are people who only read bestsellers. They only read what they read, you know, see on the New York Times bestseller list. That's part of it. But then I also think that there are some authors, probably like Michener, that you just have to put that Michener book out there, and his readers, you know, just grab the new Michener. So those books are pre-sold in a way.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I mean,
like a Broadway show
can
be pre-sold.
The minimum print order for Michener, yes. I think, is 100,000.
At least.
But, you know, when you think about it, 100,000 is not very many books when you think of all of the people in this country.
Mm-mm.
When you think of major books that are of literary importance and value having prints of 5,000 or something like that.
Yeah, it's horrible.
I read something, I think it was in Publishers Weekly, that only 1% of the adult population within a year will buy a hardcover book, a single hardcover book.
And it's getting worse. I mean, I've looked around my neighborhood lately, and all I see are new video rental stores. That's what's happening. They're going home at night and renting a movie. They're not reading books. See, we're in a dying profession.
Well, they better read Waverly Place by Susan Brettmiller. Thank you very much.